The format for this meeting is a 10-minute speaker, our secretary's announcements, and a coffee and snack break. And then our main speaker. Our first speaker for tonight is Michelle R.
Hi, my name is Michelle Reardon, and I'm an alcoholic. I've been coming to this meeting for several years, and it's interesting. Today was the day they asked me to speak. I'm not in the habit of speaking, but I'll try to share my experience, strength, and hope with you the best I can today. I started out in my drinking in my teen years, late teen years, and I grew up an athlete. My parents owned skating rinks, and I started in a skating competition when I was 9. And I pretty much was an introvert and stayed away from all the parties and everything through high school years and was totally devoted to my athletic endeavors. And so what happened to me is I started... My father wanted me to get in show business. He was in show business also, and he thought it was a good idea that I start a professional skating career, and when I did that is when I started drinking, and I never drank normal from the beginning. I lived a lifestyle of just parties, and I thought that was normal that I got drunk all the time. You know, I didn't think anything of it. As long as it worked for me, for years I went on like that. It was somewhat a periodic drunk. Whenever I drank, I got drunk. I never had one or two drinks. It just didn't seem like, it seemed like a waste of time to me right from the beginning. And then it was for the 60s then, it was like the 70s, and everybody was smoking grass or drinking or something. I was taking LSD. I was afraid of drugs. I just sat in a corner with my bottle of wine. It's basically how I got through the hippie thing. I was just like, oh, okay, is the party over now? I don't think I went to sleep for years. I just passed out. I thought that was normal. You know, I just didn't even get a clue. And I went through 2 marriages drunk, and both of them drank as much as I did. And finally, I ended up going with a doctor that was in and out of AA, and he started, whenever he decided to get sober, dragging me to meetings. And I was such a people pleaser, I just went along with the plan, you know. I thought, well, he had the problem, I'd just go along and help him. And I started relating to some of the stories, and I wouldn't tell anybody, but I kind of made me start to realize that maybe that I had a problem. I thought I was crazy. I didn't think I was a drunk. I just thought I was nuts. I knew something was wrong with me after a while, but I didn't get it, you know. And so the party had been over, and I didn't know it. And so finally, in 1981, my father passed away, and I was very close to my father, and I loved him very much, and I was very impacted by his death. And like I said, I had been drugged to these meetings unwillingly, but I was a people pleaser and went along with it. So after my father passed away about 3 months later, overwhelmed with guilt, I showed up at the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll never forget that night. I was terrified. My first meeting by myself, went there because I didn't want to drink. And the reason I came is I thought that I was just going to clean up my act and make everything better because I had let my dad down. You know, it was all about this enormous guilt, you know. And for years, I got into the program. I was real, you know, I got a sponsor right away, and I was real active in sponsoring people on H and I panels. And then I got obsessed with our commercial real estate career, stopped going to meetings, got involved with the guy that was drinking, and about 4.5, almost 5 years later, I was sitting in a bar downtown Chinatown, and he told me that if I didn't drink, he'd never see me again. And like an idiot, I picked up a drink. And 6 months later, I was worse than ever, and I was back in AA. Thank God I came back. And that's how I ended up moving to the South Bay. I was living 2 blocks from my sponsor, so it was a little hard to drink. I had to move out of town. So the beach seemed like a good idea. So I moved from Chatsworth to Lomita, and that was in 1986. And by January of 1987, I had already tried to commit suicide twice and was going into blackouts after two or three drinks, which was not my experience prior. And I was really frightened, very frightened. And I hadn't planned on coming back to the program, but January the 2nd, 1987, I walked into TLC on a Sunday night, and by the grace of God, I've been sober ever since. And I really love AA in South Bay. I was able to make amends with my sponsor, and she and I are very close, and she's still my sponsor today. In the last 9.5 years since I've been coming to meetings in the South Bay, I've been through a lot sober. Everyone has been very supportive. In 1992, I was in a very bad accident, and I couldn't work for a year, and I lost my job, and I lost my home. And then when I got well, I couldn't find work because commercial real estate hit a pretty bad bottom, and I was out of work for almost 2 years. And I never once wanted to drink over that, you know, and I'm really grateful for that. That's a gift. That's a gift that I don't take for granted. And if it hadn't been for the people in the program and the life that I have today, I shudder to think where I would have ended up or what, you know, what kind of life I would have had. I don't even think I'd be alive. And in 1993, when I was going through all that, my best friend, who was my sponsor's best friend also, went out after almost 8 years of sobriety, and she died in 6 months. And I thought, what a hell of a message to get. Here I'm going through all this trauma, and like a very close friend of mine went out and didn't make it back. And I mean, I am so grateful to be sober today. My life is better than I ever thought it would be. And I just, there's no way I could ever give back to AA what the life I have today. And I finally did find that job. And I've been working for the government for the last 1.5 years. And I thought my career was over, and now it's blossomed even more than ever. You know, if I'd have given up and thrown all the towel in, you know, what would have that gotten me? Nowhere, you know. So anyway, thanks for asking me to share, Jim.
Now our main speaker will share his experience, strength, and hope with us. Please join me in welcoming Scott R. from Sherman Oaks.
My name's Scott Redmond. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. It's great to be here tonight. I want to thank the speaker getter for getting me. And I'd like to welcome the new people, Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a great life today, and if you're new, I'm sure that thrills the crap out of you. I'm sure it really excites you. I know I was real excited for the people having a good time at AA when I got here. I was really overwhelmed for them. And I'd sit in my seat and listen to them talk about the family and the new car and the house, you know, and I'd sit in my seat and I'd think to myself, you know, maybe you go home tonight and maybe your house will blow up. Maybe your car will blow up. Maybe you'll blow up. Then we'll see how spiritual you are next week. So if you know, I'd like to welcome you to AA. If you're a drug addict, I'd like to welcome you to AA. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're the Bigfoot of dope addicts, if you're a dope juggernaut, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And catch alcoholism. Just catch alcoholism. You can have anything else you want. Just in addition to it, catch alcoholism. We have a book about alcoholism written by alcoholics. You know. And I did not have alcoholism when I got here. And my two favorites right now, by the way, I've heard dope fiend, and I've heard people lately, a couple of people identify as tweakers and crack monsters. So if you're a tweaker or a crack or a crack monster, like to welcome you to AA, and catch alcohol. We'd love to give you alcoholism if you don't have it. My sponsor is fond of pointing out the fact that you catch it at the meetings. And that's where I caught alcoholism. I caught alcoholism in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new here, I want to tell you, this is a great AA meeting. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate this meeting and being asked to come and talk here. This is a meeting that every time I've walked into, I have been welcomed. I have been shown tremendous hospitality. There's prominently displayed copies of the Big Book and AA literature here. This is a wonderful Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And if you're new and you've been going to meetings which are different, you know, if you're going to meetings and... sometimes I can go to a meeting and not even hear a passing reference made to God, the Big Book, or the 12 Steps. And I get really confused. Really confused. Sometimes you just go to a meeting and just hear about issues and boundaries. And that's fine. That's fine. But you see, you have to not drink to have an issue or a boundary. Don't drink, and I promise you'll have both an issue and a boundary. I guarantee it, but you've got to not drink. The not drinking part's a moose. If it was not for the not drinking part, we would be a much bigger organization. If you're new and you're wondering when you're going to get in touch with your feelings, stay sober, they'll get in touch with you. I guarantee it. When you cuddle up tonight and Satan descends from your ceiling, that's your feelings getting in touch with you. If you're new. I feel absolutely horrible tonight physically. My back went out on me yesterday, and I feel, you know, when your brain feels disconnected from your body, if you're new, I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about. So I'm going to do the best I can, and I came down here with a guy who's in his third day of sobriety, and I feel better than him. I know I do. And every part of his face is still moving in a different direction, and I know my friend Mike, who I love, and I'm glad he's with me tonight, and I want to thank my friend Brad for coming down with me, too. And if you're new here and you don't have alcoholism, I want to tell you that I didn't have alcoholism when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, either. Number one, I'm Jewish, and Jews don't drink, because it might dull the pain. And you certainly don't want that to happen. You don't want to squander any agony opportunity that presents itself. And if you're new and you have a reason to drink, I love reasons to drink. I love them. This friend of mine, Larry, he tells me that when he first read the first page of chapter 4 in our book, it says, facing an alcoholic death or a spiritual life is not always an easy decision to make. And he tells me that when he first read that page, the first thing that came to his mind was, well, how bad an alcoholic death are we talking about here? Yeah. Normal people, that's not their first association. So if you're new here and you have a reason to drink, I want to welcome you to AA. I have a new favorite reason to drink. It's a new one. It happened a couple of months ago, and I save reasons to drink because, man, they're great, you know. And this guy, I'm sponsoring this guy, he lives with his wife, he's a male prostitute, and he has a gay lover. And he called me to tell me he drank, and I said, why? He said, I caught my wife cheating on me. It doesn't get any better than that. No way. You can't write that. You can't make that up. No way. So if you're new here and you have a reason to drink, share it with us. Before you drink, if you're new here and you have a plan, it's probably a beaut. Don't use your plan if you're new here. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us the plan. We want to know the plan. The most newcomer plan in the last 5 years that I have come into personal intimate contact with is the one more dope deal to set myself up financially for sobriety plan. Right? There's a few heads going up and down. There is. There's. You don't get that at the Lions Club. People don't go, yeah. It's going to wind up on the soft literature rack eventually, because this sucker is out there and it's being used. In addition to being Jewish, which meant I couldn't possibly have been alcoholic, the other reason I was not alcoholic is because I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I'm not putting therapy down. Therapy is great stuff. It says on page 133 of our book, if you need a doctor, go get one. It also says in the description of step 5, no wonder those in the medical profession have such a low opinion of our chances for recovery, because we've so seldom told these good people the truth. So you might want to hook into that kind of after you treat your alcoholism. My colossal blunder is I was trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy. Psychotherapy is fine. This is not a judgment call on therapy, but I was trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy. Now, if alcoholism is a threefold illness, if it's a bizarre physical reaction that makes it impossible for me to control and enjoy my drinking or to moderate once I begin, and I continue to take this drink because of some fascinating thinking. And if you're new here, I want to tell you, you're going to hear it referred to as alcoholic thinking. And it's fabulous stuff. It's a constant source of mirth in the meetings. And, you know, if you're new here and when your head hits the pillow, if you hear one little voice say, I'm so glad you could all be here tonight, that's really when a lot of this thinking develops. And one of my favorite examples of alcoholic thinking is a friend of mine in my old home group. had been dragged from his car drunk, and he was chained to a bench in the Van Nuys police station, and he urinated on himself, and he looked at this policeman and he said, I have got to stop driving. And he didn't have a driving problem. But when the alcohol, when the drink in your hand has no connection to the condition of your life, that's fatal alcoholic denial, and that's when you're really on the road to wreck and ruin. At any rate, once I continue to take the drink, because, you know, in alcoholic thinking, the alcoholic mind is like a beautifully, perfectly tuned clock that keeps the most precise time in the universe for 1 minute and then skips a century. You know? When it works, it is a beautiful thing, and when it doesn't, it leaves gaps large enough to move an entire culture through. But when it works, it's really an extraordinary thing, you know? And, when this thinking keeps driving me to a drink that I can't stop taking, I have to rearrange my life to accommodate this walk I can't stop taking. And I have to rearrange everything in my life. And the longer I stayed in the horrible cycle of spree and remorse, I had to eventually rearrange my idea of what was okay to do as a lover, a brother, a son, a husband, a father. Everything had to be rearranged to accommodate this walk I couldn't stop taking. And what happens is you develop this sickness of the soul, this cancer of the soul that eats alcoholics up from the inside like a tapeworm and leaves them hollow and insane and alone. And what I was doing, my colossal mistake, is I was trying to treat this physical, mental, spiritual illness with psychotherapy, which is mental, which would be one-fold, a one-fold treatment for a three-fold disease. I was showing up at a gunfight with a knife, you know, over and over and over again, you know. If you're new here and you've been drinking at exactly the wrong time, if you fail to recall with sufficient force the memory of the pain and humiliation of a day, a week, a second ago, and repeat the same insane behavior over and over again, if you're new and you build up a bright outlook for yourself and your family and then rip it down around your ears in a senseless series of sprees, you could have alcoholism. If you don't, what is wrong with you? What the hell is your problem? I mean, really, consider the alternatives. You might do really well by contracting alcoholism. I grew up in the Bronx in New York City. Nobody? Nobody? Nobody here on the witness protection program? Nothing? A couple of people looking at their shoes, huh? And to a completely insane family. My family was completely out of their mind. My wife never believed me about my family until she met them. And my mother threw an engagement party for us, and my aunt came and wore her wig backwards, and it had a bun on it. It was not a mistake. It was a look she was going after. If you got anything for free in my... This is my genetic pool. I mean, I wish I was lying about this. These are my people. If you got anything for free in my family, it meant it was stolen. And I had an uncle who was a welder, and he used to get bales of free steel wool. And my aunt took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled all of the throw pillows with the steel wool. Now, after a while, that stuff works its way through on you. So when you would go to their house, if you looked at the room, everybody was moving a little bit, you know? The whole room was a pulsing, living thing, you know? Absolutely nuts. And if you're new here, all I've got is good news for you, because they did not have one single solitary thing to do with making me an alcoholic. And I'm not telling you they weren't crazy. They were. And I'm telling you the cute stuff. In addition, there was chronic institutionalization, suicide attempts, abuse, absolute insanity. They didn't have one thing to do with making me an alcoholic. If they did, I could go to psychotherapy, I could work out my family problems, and drink properly. If they were really the reason for the alcoholism, then why couldn't I work out those family problems and drink properly? I wouldn't have to go to parties anymore and say, oh, no heroin for me, I'll have a Perrier. All right? I wouldn't have to do that. I could just be like the normal people. But it doesn't matter how much therapy I do. It doesn't matter how much I work out my family problems. I must treat my alcoholism if I expect to live long or happily in this world. And I did not get it. I didn't even have it. And growing up in this family, I entered psychotherapy as a very young man at about the age of 14. I had horrible stuff happen to me. I sold heroin to a New York City policeman, and I mean, really bad stuff. And I was asked to leave a bunch of educational institutions, and because people were horrible to me. And when I took the alcoholic test, and if you're new here, we have a test. Other diseases have blood tests and x-rays. We have an inventory. And if you do the inventory, it's a pass-pass situation. All you got to do is do it and you pass. You'll actually see a picture of your alcoholism. And if you can really read the whole thing, really read the whole, I'm resentful at them. I'm resentful at me for resenting them. I'm resentful at them for watching me resent them. And I've had sex with all of them, right? Right? And I'm scared of all of them. Newcomers, what does this have to do with alcoholism? It is alcoholism. That's what alcoholism is. Read the fifth chapter of our book. If you want to know what's keeping you in the loop of spree and remorse, it says resentments and the defects of character that make them possible, fears and unsolvable sexual problems. And if you're new, I'm sure you're really excited to do a sexual inventory. I'm just sure you're thrilled and peppy just from the thought. And saved my life. And when I took that test, when I got the picture of my alcoholism, when I actually read the whole awful thing to one guy, I saw that early on people were doing things behind my back. A little later on they started talking behind my back. And in the last few horrible years, they started thinking behind my back, which is it's hard to catch them, you know, and it's an awful, awful thing. But you can catch them, you just got to accuse them of it all the time. And you'll nail those suckers eventually, you know. And it's when they started thinking behind my back, that's when my life got really, really hard, you know. I set some lofty goals for myself as a young man, and by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had reached or surpassed them all. By the time I got sober, I had a book on the bestseller list. I had acted in a Broadway play. I had directed a television show. I had directed a movie. I had had my own theater in New York. I had done all of these things a time. I never got to do any of them more than once, because when I'd leave, they'd move the business so I couldn't find it again, you know, because they were thinking behind my back. And in addition to the psychotherapy when I entered when I was 14, the other thing I did to avoid this alcoholic dilemma that I was finding myself in was I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk, and I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. And I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here tonight. You remember WOW, right? WOW. WOW. Right after WOW usually came, what? What? WOW. What? WOW. What? WOW. Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum. You know? There is a lot of activity, but no movement. But there's a lot of crap happening there, man. They're busy. They just can't get a claw in the rug, you know? Just can't get it moving. I triumphed over marijuana with pills. I was I was victorious over pills with cocaine. Cocaine's a fabulous drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I kicked that goddamn cocaine habit with heroin, and then I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk, and I went to psychotherapy and swapped addictions and didn't even begin to catch alcoholism until I was 33 years old, until I was almost dead from it. I was in my early 20s. I had slammed some heroin. My father had a massive stroke and died that night, and I couldn't show up for him or my mother or my brother, and my father was lost to me. I couldn't even think about him. I couldn't even talk about him. I couldn't look at pictures of him. I couldn't even hear the sound of a heart machine. I couldn't even walk into a hospital because the beeping of the heart machine sounded like a personal indictment of my complete collapse as a man and a son. My whole life I stood next to men 10 years younger than me, and I said, I wonder what it's like to be grown up. What a crappy way to live. You're always almost having a life. And shortly after my dad died, I met this wonderful, brilliant, gorgeous woman, and I just fell in love with her. I was acting in a Broadway play, and she was an usherette in the theater. It was very romantic, and we just fell in love together. And we had great plans and great dreams, and we didn't know that we were just a couple of dogs trying to run on linoleum, you know. She was exotic. She was from Detroit. And I want to tell you, I had never been out of the Bronx. Detroit was exotic to me. I thought they were like palm trees in Detroit. And Nancy and I became very sick together. She became sick from prolonged exposure to me, and we became so sick together that at a certain point a guy lent us his car, and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice as long as I live. On the phone, he said, you sold my car? That's like house-sitting for someone, and they come back, and you're in escrow. You sold my car. I lent you my car. And we were proud of it. The alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. It was the end of the month. We didn't have the rent. I looked into my wife's eyes. I said, sweetheart, I am so sick of acting like an irresponsible little kid. Let's not borrow money. Let's do the right thing. Let's sell the car. And she looked at me with tears in her eyes and said, let's do. We had two sons who became very, very sick from alcoholism. And when Micah was born, we were surrounded by friends and family. There was a ton of phone calls, mob of people at the hospital to visit, a lot of flowers. He was really welcomed into the world. 3 months, 2 years, and 9 months later, when Jesse was born, there was no one at the hospital, no flowers, no phone calls, nobody was around. We had been completely isolated by the disease of alcoholism in 2 years and 9 months. And it wasn't because people didn't love us. They did. It hurt too much to be around us. And Jesse had a little heart thing out of the gate, and he was taken to neonatal intensive care, and I was home, and this doctor called me and said, Mr. Redmond, your wife and your child are all alone down here, and they really need your help. You know, Jesse was up in neonatal intensive care, and Nancy's in the room just going crazy because she's seeing other mothers with their babies, and she doesn't know what's going on. And I said to this doctor, the fact is I can't find anybody to watch my two-year-old boy. I can't come down. And this doctor, who I had never met before, said to me on the phone that night, I tell you what,
why don't I give you my address? You take your son over to my house, and my husband will watch him so you can come down and be with your family. And I said no. There was no way I could accept the help. I was too racked by self-loathing and guilt. And now I'm not doing my kid any favor. Now he's locked in the house with this insane, guilty father who's going out of his mind. I would have done better to take him to the hospital and leave him in the waiting room with a coloring book. At least he could have gotten away from me for a while. And this is the state that we came to Alcoholics Anonymous in. When Michael was 5 years old, he walked up to me and he said, Daddy, is there anything such as God? And I looked into the eyes of my perfect, beautiful little baby boy, and I said, Micah, there isn't. And I thought I was giving him the real deal. I thought I was saving him some skin. I thought I was saving him some trouble so he wouldn't have to be played like the saps and suckers out there. I really thought I was doing him a favor. And not only did I give him probably the worst information you can possibly give a baby, which is that you're all alone, that when your head hits the pillow at night and the anxiety comes up, you're all alone. Not only did I give him that, but I lied to him. It's mushy thinking. It's weak thinking. And if you're new here, I urge you to read the fourth chapter of our book. Because the thinking I thought was the bravest, the gutsiest, the realest thinking, which was to take a stand and say, this is not so, is in fact the weakest of thinking. Because it requires a complete omission, a near complete omission, of most of the evidence that's in front of you. And I don't really know what you could do to a baby that is really much worse than that. On April 20th, 1985, I crossed the line I swore I would never cross again. You see, after my father died and I had slammed dope that night, I knew what the problem was. I knew what to do about it. I knew that what the problem was, and I swore I would never, ever shoot heroin again. Because that's really what had caused this horrible experience with my dad. So I was okay as long as I didn't cross that line. 13 years later, I put a needle in my arm because it was there, because it was in front of me. And my world came crashing down around me, and I called my therapist of record at that particular time. A Jungian therapist. It was my first Jungian, and that was very important. Because after I was to come to AA and read our book, I was to find out that Carl Jung played a major role in the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason why is because Carl Jung did exactly what this therapist did for me that morning, and I didn't know it. Carl Jung said to the man who 12-stepped Bill Wilson, he said to that man, there's absolutely nothing that can be done for you. And that morning when I called that therapist and I told him I had shot dope again, I told him what had happened, he said to me, I can't do anything for you. I can't help you. The only thing that I can suggest is you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, or we have you institutionalized. Now, why I went to that AA meeting, I have no idea. On any other morning that I can think of, I would have gladly chosen the institution. It would have been a chance to be with my people, colorful, adventurous people, my people. Why I went to that AA meeting, I don't know. But I'll tell you, if you're new here tonight and you're anything like me, I walked into that meeting, I looked around, and I just could not believe that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not believe it. I just looked around the room and said, Alcoholics Anonymous. How did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is lamer than church, lamer than synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything was a miracle, 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 miracle. The furniture's a miracle. The coffee's a miracle, miracle, miracle. Oh. And if you're new, you are now privy to an unending, unsolicited reservoir of information and advice. They're going to get right up in your face and talk that long AA crap to you, man. It's usually a guy with one tooth with a cavity in it. You know the guy's wearing a belt buckle large enough to serve a whole fish on, right? Do I want what you've got? No! But thanks for spitting on me. I really appreciate it. And the only reason I can think of that I came back is that I was out of plans. I hated every single thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came back, and I came back, and I stuck around for 6 months, and I knew I was going to drink. I was enjoying the gift of step none. And, you know the gift of step none? Nothing. And I had been here 6 months, and I had seen the AA drill literally hundreds of times in just 6 months. People came in, surrendered, did the work, and changed. People came in, didn't surrender, didn't do the work, got sick, got sicker, got to the podium, shared their gift with us, and then shared the rest right out of the door. Now, if you're new here, I want to urge you to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to urge you, if you can read it with some people who are familiar with it, even better, because it's going to clear up the meetings for you. I guarantee, if you get acquainted with this stuff, you'll be able to go to meetings and listen to the sharing and say to yourself, oh, he's talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. He's not talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what he's talking about. But I judge no man. It's an evaluation, not a judgment. And I knew I was going to drink. And what had happened in my home was my wife had reached out to the Al-Anon family groups. And one of the most confusing and hurtful things to me when I first came to AA is I heard people at AA podiums and off AA podiums telling jokes about Al-Anon. I'm not talking about good-natured jokes. God knows we tell enough good-natured jokes about alcoholics. I'm talking about hurtful, mean, ignorant jokes. But again, I judge no man. And until I stuck around long enough to find out that these people had no functioning knowledge of the work done in the Al-Anon family groups, that they were just mean, ignorant, and hurtful, although I judge no man, I felt very confused and very hurt by it because I was so proud of my wife for reaching out and finding her own miracle. And if you're doing that on a public level, that's your vote that it's okay. I'm down to one vote. I used to have all the votes. I'm down to one now. And my vote's that it's not okay. My vote said it's not okay because there might be a newcomer out there who's lucky enough to be involved with someone who is working the 12 steps to help them live with alcoholism. And if you are, Godspeed. I wish you all the best. And what had happened was, because Nancy had reached out and because I saw a demonstration of the power of God, no matter how primitive at that time, and my sons had become less frightened all the time, I decided to get a sponsor. I decided to not continue getting the gift of step none and actually get involved with somebody who was involved with the program. And this guy made sure I'd done some reading from the big book, and he invited me to his apartment, and he read chapter 5 to me, and he took me through the first two steps. We reached step 3 and made a decision and prayed. And then he finished chapter 5, and he went back and he gave me instructions on how to do a fourth step from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, some people say, and I know it's true for them, that they mostly resented themselves. I know that's true for them, and I know it's absolutely not true for me. I hated myself, but nothing compared to how much I hated you. I hated you so much more than I hated me, it's difficult to describe. I am not a suicide guy. I'm a homicide guy, you know. I vastly prefer your death to mine. I always have, you know. And I'm not knocking the suicide people. Right, this is not a knock. It's kind of the flip side of the same coin, you know, but as with me, you go first. That's just where I've always gone. So I had a lot of work to do. And it took me 3 months. I went back to my sponsor. I read my fifth step to him at 9 months of sobriety. I did step 6 and 7 for the first time, and it came time to do my eighth step list. I try to share this anytime I talk because it's the best reading of the eighth step I've ever heard in my life. And it was done by a guy from my old home group named Nino. I'd never seen him before this night, and I've never seen him since. He was there with a hospital group. He had never read chapter 5 before. He had a heavy New York accent. He had hospital plastic on, and he was reading chapter 5 for the first time in front of this men's group. And he got up to step 8, and he read, "Made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all." Jesus Christ! And he looked up into the room as if to say, have you seen this? Do you know what's in here, man? It was so beautiful. It was so pure. It was the best reading of the eighth step, because it's all I saw when I saw the steps. It's the only step. Not those people, not that money. I would not have taken that much money if I knew I had to pay it back, man. Right? No way. Not the car. So if you're new here, don't worry about it. It's eight steps from where you are anyway. So it's really not eight that's the annoying one. It's nine. So I made up my eight-step list, and I put my wife and my kids and my dad down there, and I didn't know what I was going to do. My dad was dead. And I asked, you know, my sponsor said, do your job in AA, see what happens. I said, he's dead. And Don said, yeah, I know. Do your job in AA, see what happens. Do your job. I don't know what I was going to do with Nancy and the boys. Let's see. I'll sit down with Nancy and I'll say, gee, honey, I'm so sorry about this 8-year journey to Hades. Okay? I'll sit down with the kids. I'll say, boys, I'm so sorry you've had no life. Forgive me? I don't think so. I had to start doing a lot of lame crap. I had to start going to flag football games and coaching the Little League. I had to stop telling my kids to go do their homework and start saying, do you need any help with your homework? Not that I could have helped them, you know. They're learning stuff in the fourth grade I don't even get. But what I could do is I could take some heroin money and spend it on a tutor. I could take some alcohol money and spend it on materials. I could go into their schools and advocate for them and get every drop of money that they're due in terms of resources. And that's what I did. And I asked questions, and I got good information, and I kept standing up for my kids because I never stood up for them before. And first time I went over to a Little League game, Nancy comes over to the game and takes one look over at the first base stands and falls down laughing. Because there's everybody, all the people in the stands, and there's me alone in the sun, pissed off, you know? Absolutely nuts. I'm here, I'm making amends, I'm here, I'm doing my job. Kids were thrilled to see me, you know? I'm going up and down two hat sizes in the sun by myself. Mr. Redmond's going to blow up, man, I'm telling you. Nuts! It took me a couple of years for the voices to diminish in volume and number to get over and be with the people in the stands. Just sit with the people in the stands. Oh, man. And a couple of years ago, Jesse got one of the greatest compliments a human being can get. He was intentionally walked at a game. Yeah. Doesn't get much better than that, you know. And he didn't want to be a geek and jump up and down. You know, he just laid his bat down. He trotted up the first baseline. And on the way up the first baseline, he just got me in the stands, and he just shot me that much stuff. Just that much. Not too much. You don't want to be lame. It's the old man. You don't want to do much. Yeah. And I could have missed the whole thing. I could have missed the whole thing by a second and an inch, you know. And if you're new here, I'm sure you're thrilled for Jesse and I. And
a baseball story.
And I felt that way too. But you know, somewhere in the back of my head, because I had done so many horrible things on my kids' birthdays, because my brother and I never went to school with ripped clothing and never missed a meal, and my old man never made more than $10,000 a year. My last year out there, I made $80,000. My children went to school with ripped clothing all the time and missed meals all the time. And my first year of sobriety, I started sponsoring men. I was very fortunate, and I'm really glad I started working with men that early in sobriety. And, you know, this son that I told you about, Micah, who I hurt so terribly. And by the time I got to AA, Micah was making involuntary clicking noises with his throat that he couldn't stop making. He couldn't stop grinding his teeth. He was reading and writing years below his grade level. His small motor skills were blown to hell because he was just so distracted from being scared all the time. And in my first year, I sponsored a guy named Roland, and Roland used to call my house every single night, and he would leave a message on the tape every single night, and it would say, "Scott, it's Roly. I love you. I'm sober. Good night," and he'd hang up. Years later, I think I was 5 years sober, my son Micah told me that he couldn't fall asleep until he heard Roland's voice on the tape. And once he heard Roland's voice on the tape, he knew nothing had changed. And he could, because I think the kid used to be so wired and scared that he used to stay up till he passed out. But when he'd hear Roly's voice on the tape, he knew sobriety was still in the house. That was the demonstration of the power of God. Not, "I'm sorry." "I'm sorry" were the two most meaningless words in my vocabulary. Not a couple of baseball games. 5 years of baseball games. My family didn't give me a first year cake. They didn't quite buy it yet. And, of course, he told us this when Roland needed to hear it. Micah didn't know that. Micah didn't know that Roland had come to me thinking that he hadn't helped anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then Micah came to, you know, because Roland needed to hear that. And my wife and I had to stop working on our marriage. My idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until you change your mind. That's my idea of working on a relationship, is to talk to you until your eyes roll back in your head and you keel over, and on the way down you go, "Oh, okay." I had to take the sexual inventory from the second paragraph of page 69, and I had to start applying it to my life. Where have I been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate? It asks us to write about 7 different points. Where have I been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate? Where have I unjustifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? And what should I do instead? Not what could I do. What should I do? And then it says, in this way I try to shape a sound ideal for my future life. I don't say sex life, I say life, because I want this to be a model for my life. I ask God to help mold me, to help me walk toward it. What an extraordinary endeavor to get involved in. I went to psychologists my whole life. Alcoholics Anonymous is moral psychology. It's psychology with a moral application. And I never had that in psychotherapy, a moral application, and I kept getting sicker and sicker because of the soul sickness of alcoholism. And when you guys gave me a moral application for this stuff I was figuring out, I got to put it into action, and I actually started acting like the man I always wanted to be. 2 weeks before I got sober, I reached for something across our dinner table. My hand came near my son, and he went like this, on reflex. And I just crumbled. That is never a place I even imagined that I would wind up. And it was a reflex. He didn't even think about it. That was what was even more terrifying to me. And when I started taking a look at this and taking a look at my partnership with my wife in the framework of this inventory, I started getting some pretty remarkable results. Where have I been selfish? I want what I want when I want it. Where have I been dishonest? When I started really looking at the dishonesty in my marriage, it was remarkable. For instance, and I told you I never felt like a grown man. Now, a grown man should live in a clean house. That stands to reason. That's one thing grown guys do, grown-ups do. They make a bed, they live in a clean house. That's a grown-up thing to do. But I'm not cleaning the house to live in a clean house. I'm cleaning the house because somewhere in the back of my twisted noodle, I think that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. Right? That there should be like conversion tables on the back of cleaning products.
Yeah. Right?
Of housework to sex. That's what I think. So I'm not cleaning the house to live in a clean house. I'm cleaning the house and I'm saying to my wife, "I'm finished, honey." When I started cleaning the house to live in a clean house, I stopped looking at guys 10 years younger than me and saying, "I wonder what it's like to feel grown up." That was the answer. It wasn't working it out in therapy for me. It was cleaning the house. Now, I don't know how to clean the house, and I don't like to clean the house. So I don't do it for my wife. I don't do it for me. I do it for God. Miracle, miracle, miracle. I'm cleaning the house for God. Oh, I'm so sorry you didn't tell me that on my first day in Alcoholics Anonymous. Someday you'll clean your house for God. I wonder if I can get off more than one round. Ooh, take me to that book, babe. Man. I was eventually able to show up for a guy during his death when I couldn't show up for my father, and my father came back into my life because I did my work in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a guy who I sponsored who pissed a lot of people off, and I didn't tell the guy what I thought of him. And when he got sick and he was dying, he had nobody else to call except me because I kept my mouth shut. It says in our book, when a person offended, we said to ourselves. It doesn't say we said to them, and it doesn't say we said to ourselves loud enough so that they can hear us. It just says we said to ourselves, this is a sick man, God save me from being angry, thy will be done, not mine. Some people pray for people when they have resentments against them. I don't. It doesn't work for me. And I know it works for some people, and I'm not putting it down. But when I do the prayer, it always, this is the way the prayer goes. Father, help this man. Kill this man. Kill this miserable son of a bitch. He needs killing. It'll be better for everybody. So I like that other little prayer. It says, pray for yourself. It says, basically, pray for yourself. God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done, not mine. I get that. I can do that. And when I sit down and I said, I'm resentful at blank for ripping people off in AA. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A five-bagger for sure. And then I list the defects of character that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone. What am I going to ask God to take away? The guy? The theft? Me? What am I asking God to take away? What is it in me? What poison in me, if God came down with a magic wand and touched me on the head and it was gone, would I be able to live? Resentment's no big deal. It's just the source of all spiritual illness, the great destroyer of all alcoholics. It'll cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit, drag your ass out, and kill you dead. But don't be alarmed. No biggie. No biggie. Take your time with that inventory. Man. I'm a people pleaser. I cared more about how I was seen in AA than what this guy was going through. I was self-centered. I didn't rip any people off. I was spiritually prideful. How could a man do such a thing after coming into contact with someone of my spiritual caliber? I'm a retaliator and judgmental. I don't even have to open my mouth to do that. That happens right here when my head hits the pillow and it becomes a rotisserie. Then I go to God in 6 and 7 and I say, Father, can you help me? Humbly ask him to remove these defects, my shortcomings. Humbly isn't, take him if you can, big guy. Humbly isn't, take him, you rotten son of a bitch. Humbly is, Father, can you do this for me? Can you please, please help me? I can't bear it anymore. Will you show me what you want me to do for you? Please do my work and reveal your work to me. It says when I drew close to him, he revealed himself to me. And this is how I draw close to him. And my life just kept getting better and better and better. Despite terrible personal problems, terrible financial setbacks and calamity, deaths, all sorts of stuff. But I got something early on. You know, when I came into AA, I heard people talking about God getting them jobs, you know, God getting people relationships, God getting people parking spaces, you know. And not the parking God, you know. What if you don't get a space? And if you have a parking God and God gets you a space, why don't you be of some service and give it to the person behind you? And what I had to do for me is I had to get a God big enough, and my sponsor told me that I could use his God till mine got big enough, where a lot of stuff could happen in his universe and I didn't get to drink, where I didn't get to use the Holocaust, where I didn't get to use bad luck, where I didn't get to use all of this stuff as a reason to drink. Carter cheating on me. We got really creamed in the Northridge earthquake. We live in Sherman Oaks, and I mean, we got battered. The house got wrecked up real bad, and I got the backache, the back problem that I'm suffering from tonight, I got during the quake. We got just smeared. And about a month later, we were out of town at an AA function, and a woman said to me at this function, I'm so glad that God got us out of L.A. before the earthquake. And I said, oh. He likes you. He likes you. And we're crap. But he likes you. And she said, no, I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn. Oh, bartender. Oh, bartender, hello. I'm out of here. If I got a guy up there saying, get the Redmond boy, get him. No evacuation plan for him. Get him. Kill his goat, put a finger in his eye, and turn his wife to salt. Get him. I'm out of here. That God would not keep me sober for 10 seconds. I wouldn't be caught in a dark alley with that God. I get today, and this is just for me, that earthquakes are geology and God is spirituality. This is just for me. Because if I believed any other way that God was had set up this obstacle course for me, I don't want any part of it. Any part of it. And a couple of months ago, one of the guys I sponsor passed away. And I held him, and we took the first three steps together. We took the seventh step together, the 11th step together. And I looked into Jim's eyes, and I said, do you understand that you've done good work here? And he looked at me, and he said, yes, I do. And then he turned to a guy by the side of the bed, and he said, I'm okay, I'm sober, and he died. And how could I be present for such a day? I mean, I couldn't even get there for my dad. And I've never felt the presence of my father more powerfully. I've never felt so relieved. The sound of the heart machine is no longer an indictment of me. If you're new here, I don't know what you're coming in with. I don't know what your black hole was. I know that my child, who my arm came next to him and he flinched over 11 years ago, he wanted to go to colleges, and he and I got into a car and last month and drove 2,500 miles together, got out of the car, hugged and kissed each other, and told each other what a great time we had. We can't get enough of each other. So I don't know what you're coming in with. I want to tell you, if you're new, I think you're in a terribly dangerous situation. If unless you've had some kind of big spiritual displacement, our book says you can't get sober. If you really have alcoholism, you can't get sober without a spiritual experience. And what we're basically saying to you is we know you have not had the thing that is necessary to stop drinking. Please don't drink till you get it. It's this horrible gray area, this in-between place where you do not have the thing, you're trying to get the thing, and we're asking you to take the whooping. Stop treating your own alcoholism. When you want to drink, don't. Don't drink. Call one of us. Crawl on your belly. Don't drink. Every craving has a beginning, a middle, and an end. If you you've been treating your craving with a drink. Stop treating your craving. It'll break over you like a wave. You can feel it. And you can make a deal with a God that you might not believe in, might not want to believe in, and don't understand. You can say, Father, please, I'll accept the craving. And I won't treat the craving with alcohol. Will you please remove the obsession? You can make that deal tonight and call one of us. Sometimes a newcomer will say to me, drinking is the furthest thing from my mind. To which I usually reply, no. Your mind is the furthest thing from your mind. And I'm not criticizing you, and that's not a knock. I just want to tell you why we're so unimpressed with the fact that drinking is the furthest thing from your mind. To the best of my knowledge, virtually the entire big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is engineered in part to try to drive home one simple idea. That if you have alcoholism, and drinking is the furthest thing from your mind, if you have every reason in the world not to drink, if you're not even entertaining the thought, boom, you put whiskey in your milk. That is the primary nature of the illness. So we're not concerned with proximity. It doesn't say you'll see it, it'll be a little tiny drink. You'll think about it a little. Next day it'll be a little bigger. Incoming. It doesn't. It says, boom, you're drunk. Boom. Unless you can get out of this loop of spree and remorse with these 12 steps. This kit is spiritual tools, not spiritual weapons. And what you can get involved in is the cycle, the loop of recovery, which is surrender and commitment. And every little commitment can create a bigger opportunity for surrender, and every opportunity for surrender can create an opportunity for a bigger commitment. The cycle here is just as big. I don't live as though my head's out to get me. I really don't, a good portion of the time. I no longer refer to my brain in the third person as if it is some unwanted alien dashing around my house. Some people say the road gets narrower. It doesn't for me. My life's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. It's no place in the first 164 pages of our book. The first 164 pages of our book talks about the broad highway. says come become part of the big idea, the great reality. Help us pack things into the mainstream of life. All it talks about is life becoming more inclusive, not exclusive. Just to let you know how scared my wife is of me today, some months ago, she said, you got to take Mike to the dentist. It's our older son. And I said, oh, I have to take him? Where will you be? She said, let's see, where will I be? I'll be dancing around the house naked, screaming, I'm not taking him, I'm not taking him. If you're new here, I want to welcome you to AA. I want to tell you one of my favorite newcomer stories before I sit down tonight. And I want to urge you, if you're new, I want to urge you to try to appreciate the seriousness of the situation you're in. I think you're in a very, very dangerous situation. And alcoholism is trivialized by people who don't have it. You're going to hear some pretty moronic things about alcoholism. One of my favorites is, oh, isn't AA just a crutch? Which is just like saying to a diabetic, are you still, like, using that insulin crutch? I mean, don't you have any gumption? I was at a meeting, and I met a new guy, and he was 2 weeks sober, and I went home, and he called me, and he spent an hour on the phone with me, and I said, uh-huh, four times, so he'd know I wasn't dead. And in the hour, he explained to me that he had been stalking several women, and he had a restraining order taken against him, but everything's different now. He's 2 weeks sober, and everything's different. And then at the end of the hour, he said to me, I feel so alone. And I said, oh, what do you mean? I don't even know you, and I just listened to you for an hour without interrupting. And he said, I mean, I don't have a woman. And I said, well, what exactly would you be bringing to a relationship right now besides stalking skills? What are you bringing to the party, pal? People with leukemia, 2 weeks into remission, are not having dating problems. If you're new and you're having dating problems, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd love to give it to you. Thank you.